It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, we'll look at what to expect from the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. I'm Tom Busby in New York.
I'm Stephen Carroll in London. We're looking ahead to German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's trip to China amid trade tensions with the EU.
I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. We look ahead to a ton of eco data in China. And as usual, we hunt for a catalyst that might fire up the Chinese economic engine.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, DAB Digital Radio London, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Tom Busby, and we begin today's program with the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank. This coming week, central bank leaders and finance ministers from around the world gather in Washington, D.C. to discuss interest rates, monetary policy, and other issues of global concern. For more on what to expect, we're joined by Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Well, Michael, in a written statement to be delivered this week, the managing director of the IMF says it'll push its global growth forecast slightly higher, up one notch to 3.2% in 2025. That's despite stubbornly high inflation, massive debt loads. What's behind that rather upbeat assessment?
The fact that the economy of the United States in particular, but other economies around the world, have been able to grow faster than people anticipated coming out of the recession. Now, we've talked many, many times about the weirdness of this pandemic recession and how it has upended all kinds of economic ideas and forecasts. And the IMF is just reflecting what reality is, that whether we understand it or not, things are better than we had thought.
Well, the IMF predicting U.S. growth this year, 2.1%. It's not going to blow anyone away, but it's pretty steady. And actually a drop in 2025, 1.7%. Why is that?
There's a feeling that we can't sustain this growth level, but I don't think there's a whole lot of confidence behind that prediction. The other thing that's important to realize about the world economic outlook, which is what the IMF will be putting out next week with actual numbers, and basically nobody pays any attention to the numbers they generate for the U.S. and the European Union and the United Kingdom, Japan, China, because there are people, thousands of people paid around the world to do that. Where the IMF does get some interest is especially people who trade in emerging markets, because those aren't covered as well, and they really do have the depth of information about what's going on in those countries. It's not a lot of value add to say the U.S. is going to grow 2.1% when the Fed is already saying it's going to grow 2.1%, and everybody on Wall Street is weighing in on how much it's going to grow.
So it's those sleeper countries, like you say, not Japan, not the Eurozone, not China. Mm-hmm. But the ones maybe on the back burner.
Right. Yeah, frontier markets, emerging markets.
Okay. Now, China forecasting pretty solid growth.
That's not exactly a sluggish economy, is it? It's just not what we're used to seeing in China.
Right. They've started to run into the law of large numbers, that it's really hard to keep improving at the same rate when you start to get as large as their economy is right now. They're also going through something of a recession there and a real credit issue problem. So we don't know. There isn't a lot of faith, put it that way, in Chinese economic data. So we don't know for sure how fast they're growing. And it is interesting to see what the IMF will say, because there are a lot of private sector economists who think China's growing a lot more slowly than the numbers that China will put out.
Yeah.
The only odd thing about it, or not odd thing about it, but the only thing is it's really hard to invest in China. So it's not like you're going to be using a lot of these numbers just to readjust your portfolio.
Got it. Well, one thing that we know is going to be talked about, and that is interest rates. We saw Christine Lagarde from the ECB just this week holding steady. We know here we're in sort of a holding pattern in the U.S. on interest rates, at least maybe even till later in the year. What's going to be the big discussion?
Well, you know, when they were meeting last fall, there was a lot of talk about interest rates eventually coming down, because we've sort of gotten through the recession and we'd sort of gotten through inflation and things were getting better. And now the conversation is going to be different, because the major central banks are all stepping back from the precipice of rate cuts, with the exception of the ECB, because they're at this point still worried about the possibility of inflation resurging. The conversations at the IMF meetings, World Bank meetings, will be basically around the idea of synchronicity. Will everybody be moving at once, or will somebody move much faster than everyone else? And in her news conference last week, Christine Lagarde was asked about that, because what happens is if you cut your interest rate and others don't, then your currency is going to fall. And it's just more attractive to invest in the higher rate countries. She did not want to comment on that, but you can bet that's going to be one of the discussion points behind closed doors at the meetings.
And another one, because of all this geopolitical risk out there in the Middle East, Ukraine and Russia, I mean, that has got to be also forefront on the agenda. What to do and when to do it?
Well, this is an opportunity for a lot of discussions, because the finance and foreign ministers from all over the world come and attend, along with central bankers, these meetings, and they have a lot of meetings together. And so that sort of thing will get discussed. You just can't expect any kind of answers or conclusions about what should be done, because if they haven't got it right now, just a few more meetings in Washington next week aren't going to make a difference.
No, and the meetings are here. What role does the U.S. play in these meetings and in the World Bank and the IMF?
Well, the U.S. is the host. We're the biggest economy in the world, and we have perhaps the best infrastructure for bringing all of these people together from the disparate countries of the world. And so twice a year, they come to the U.S. and they hold the IMF and World Bank meetings. And we're the headquarters for the IMF and the World Bank. So this is the place where they can get things done.
Well, it's a lot to look forward to. Our thanks to Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Next week, we get a sense of how cautious consumers are being with their money. We get U.S. retail sales data for March. That's out on Monday. Also, how could this possibly impact Fed policy going forward? And for more, we're joined by Anna Wong, Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist. So, Anna, what are you expecting to see in the March retail sales number?
Right. We are expecting to see a tepid number. I think there are various signs pointing to consumers being exhausted by the price increases over the past 2 years. We saw that in March, purchases of cars has fallen sharply, and that was following a rebound in February after another slump in January. But if you smooth over the first 3 months of the year, it is clearly showing a slowdown. And that's consistent with what we're seeing in also auto loans rejections. It's harder to get financing to auto loans, given that auto loan rates are still pretty high. And for the category of retail that directly go into Q1 GDP, it's the control group's sales, which excludes vehicles, gasoline, food services, and building materials, we are expecting a tepid 0.2% gains. That's versus 0% in the previous month. I think that overall, the U.S. consumption will be growing at about the 2% pace in the first quarter. And that's a slowdown from the more than 3% in the fourth quarter. And I think that as we go into the year, the slowdown will further be more evident. And by the end of the year, we're only expecting a 1% quarterly growth in PCE spending.
So a steady decline in spending. Do you attribute this mostly to inflation? I mean, everywhere you go, everything costs more. Every time you go to the store, you go out to dinner, you look at a sticker on a car, everything.
Yeah, it's both a combination of inflation and also increasing job insecurity. Layoffs, announcements have risen in news headlines, and that naturally could make people more cautious. And that would how that translate to spending behavior is that people would think, okay, I don't know if I'm on the chopping block next, I better not spend as much. And so saving rates should overall increase as a result of this caution. So in the March CPI report that was released last week, we saw that a few consumer categories prices fall. So for example, recreational goods and consumer electronics were two categories in the core goods category that saw very sharp decline in prices. And I think that reflects that the discretionary component of consumer budget is being slimmed down because they have to pay, you know, 20% higher for auto insurance, and auto insurance is non-negotiable. It's a big part of consumer spending because everybody needs to drive a car. And as a result, what we are seeing is less spending on things that could be cut. And that will show up in the retail as well, that I think the retail goods component, discretionary goods spending, will see a decline, whereas most of the spending is coming from services, and which is benefiting from the stock rally in the past couple months. And people who are primarily spending in services are the people who are benefiting from the market rally, and they tend to be older people, baby boomers. So that's a two-track economy for you.
Well, another thing I want to talk to you about, non-discretionary, is the price at the gas pump, which has been going up steadily since the start of the year. AAA predicting gas will average $4 a gallon by the summer. How will that affect budgets and spending?
So gasoline and food, especially for the lower income household, account for more than a fifth of their budget. So it will definitely squeeze the budget. It's not a very comforting thing for a household. The only thing that could offset that somewhat is the hike in minimum wage across many states early in the year. So in California, we just saw early this month in April that fast food workers' minimum wage have been increased by almost 20%. And in Florida, for example, early this year, the state hiked minimum wage by 17%. So there's still hope for the lower income household who could see, you know, 10 to 20% jump in their wages.
March retail sales data out on Monday. And our thanks to Anna Wong, Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, why Germany's chancellor is heading to China. I'm Tom Busby, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Tom Busby in New York. Up later in our program, a look at some key economic data coming out of China. But first, as China's economy struggles to recover, diplomatic relations become more crucial. On the heels of U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's visit to Beijing last week, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz set to visit the region in the coming days. For more, let's go to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Stephen Carroll.
Tom, Janet Yellen went to China with the message that Beijing's manufacturing drive is a threat to other economies. Her comments, at times strongly worded, were respectfully received by her hosts, but aren't likely to result in a policy shift. So as Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz makes the trip to Beijing, can he hope for any more? European countries have taken a different approach to their relationship with China versus what the United States is doing. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has described the strategy as de-risking rather than decoupling. That hasn't stopped the EU launching a competition investigation into Chinese subsidies for green industries. Olaf Scholz will be conscious that German companies are a major exporter to China, so he must be cautious. A recent survey by the German Chamber of Commerce in China highlighted the challenges that many Western firms have mentioned before. Two-thirds of those operating in the country say they face unfair competition in the market, a problem that threatens to push up their costs and erode profit margins. Scholz's discussions in China will also be set against a backdrop of geopolitical unrest, continued tensions in the Middle East, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine are set to feature heavily during the upcoming G7 foreign ministers meeting in Italy. I've been discussing the implication of Scholz's visit to China and that meeting with Bloomberg's EMEA news director Rosalind Matheson. I started by asking her how different Scholz's time in China will be to that of the trip by US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
Well, it'll be similar but also a bit different, as you say, because the relationship between China and Germany is a bit different to the relationship between China and the US, although there are similarities in terms of the challenges around the business environment. And so you can expect that the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz will be echoing some of what Janet Yellen was saying on her recent trip, the challenges for German companies operating there, clarity around that business environment, certainty around supply chains. Specifically, though, for him, the issue of electric vehicles will probably come up again, and the tensions over Chinese support for their companies and the broader EU probe that's going on into that support. So there'll be some similarities around the messaging that's going to come from Olaf Scholz, but also Germany's tended to take a slightly more careful line about the overall relationship. The US has been willing to criticize China more overtly on the human rights front, for example, and over what they see as its militarization of areas like the South China Sea, tensions with Taiwan. That doesn't mean that Olaf Scholz won't bring those things up, but Germany is traditionally has just been a bit more cautious about some of their rhetoric because they really need the economic relationship with China to work.
Yeah, I mean, the President of the European Commission has used this expression, de-risking, not decoupling, when it comes to the relationship with China. Is Olaf Scholz likely to step outside of that in his comments as he's meeting officials?
Well, so far he's really maintained, by and large, the sort of the tone taken by his predecessor, Angela Merkel. And she was very much about, you know, similarly with other countries like Russia, I would add, keeping the dialogue going, keeping the conversation going, preserving the economic and trade relationship out of the view that if you bind yourselves economically and through investment and trade, then you're more likely to be able to behave better with each other on the political side. And that's very much the sort of the tone and philosophy adopted by Olaf Scholz since he came to power. And of course, as someone who was very much part of the Merkel era himself, he has gotten a bit harder, I would say, than Angela Merkel did on the political front. But that's also because Germany is under pressure within Europe to take that harder line. You see France, you see the UK, you see the EU as a whole pressing China quite heavily on its behavior. behavior over trade, over market access, over its tech companies, and over its behavior around things like human rights. And Germany's been seen as a bit of an outlier. So he's been pushed quite heavily by his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, to do that. So you might see that slightly harder tone, but generally he's been consistent with his predecessor's policy.
Yeah, because part of this trip will involve Olaf Scholz also visiting German companies that operate in China. A survey from the German Chamber of Commerce in China found that 2/3 of German companies that operate in the country say they face unfair competition in the market. I mean, realistically, does Olaf Scholz have any leverage to tackle something like that, given that, you know, even Janet Yellen seemed to have difficulty in getting any actual movement?
Very unlikely. If Janet Yellen can't succeed, I wouldn't imagine that Olaf Scholz will. I mean, those surveys that show that companies, you know, German companies or British companies or American companies are complaining about the environment in China are very, very common. And that sort of figure is not surprising, because those concerns are longstanding about the ability to have clarity around market access and Chinese support for their own industry and so on. So that's not going to, I think, affect Olaf Scholz on his trip, although it does sort of show again the need to really be showing that he's listening to those concerns. But is the Chinese leadership going to take their cues from Germany? Probably not. What they are interested potentially doing is bifurcating a bit, because China's quite good at trying to play countries a bit against each other. And what they might do is, you know, they'll have a certain tone with Germany that they won't have with the US, for example. They'll be keen to keep Germany probably closer in the tent right now, because that's to their advantage to have that kind of sense of potential disunity in Europe over a China policy. So it's all about playing those kind of games, really. And so they're not going to change their policy simply because Olaf Scholz asked them to. They certainly wouldn't do it even if Janet Yellen asked them to, because they're really playing their own game there. But it'll be interesting to see how, you know, or whether they try and keep Germany peeled off from the rest of the pack.
Because, I mean, there is something in common that China and Germany have is weakness in their economies as well, for slightly different reasons. Are there matters of common ground that we could see sort of flagship announcements or issues where they emerge with some positive cooperation?
Well, certainly it's not just a one-way street, and that's a really important point that you make. I mean, obviously Germany and the US need China economically and for business, but China also needs them for business. The Chinese economy has been quite weak of late. It's showing a few green shoots at the moment, but certainly it's nowhere on the level that it was some years ago, pre-pandemic. And Xi Jinping is very consciously aware of that. He does need his economy to be stable. And so there are some mutual interests there. You can imagine there'll be lots of positive rhetoric in a way, like there was with Janet Yellen, also about the relationship, about being open for business, about China being ready to engage with these companies. That obviously, you know, doesn't necessarily reflect reality, but there'll be that rhetoric and that sense of mutual need. You can also imagine there'll be conversations around areas of mutual interest globally between Germany and China. And one key one there, obviously, is Russia's actions in Ukraine with the war there. You can imagine there'll be conversation around that. There'll be conversation around the Middle East and the war in Gaza. There'll be conversations around disruptions to shipping and global supply chains. So some of those broader topics will definitely come up.
Of course, and some of those issues are also going to feature at the other big geopolitical event in the coming days, which is the G7 foreign ministers meeting that's happening in Italy. What are we likely to hear on things like Russia-Ukraine at that meeting?
Well, certainly you're going to expect general expressions of support for Ukraine, of unity, because the G7 has been very unified in general around the need to keep supporting Ukraine. And what you may see, of course, is disagreements over in what way to keep supporting Ukraine, because, of course, the US is sitting on a very, very big aid package for months that's unlikely to be unlocked anytime soon, in a sense that maybe Europe is left holding the can more than they did previously for military and financial support for Ukraine. So that's definitely going to be one topic for conversation, is that they all need to be pulling their weight when it comes to that. There'll probably be conversations with Ukraine on the table in terms of the future of the war. Is there a need at some point to crack open the door to negotiations with Russia? Does there have to be some sense of getting a deal as this war goes on? And Ukraine certainly is on the back foot a bit, at least on the ground inside Ukraine itself. top. So that will probably be the two major topics when it comes to Ukraine, and then that broader conversation around how Europe can beef up its own defence and its own defence spending.
That's our EMEA news director, Rosalind Matheson. Now, as Ros was telling us, geopolitical tensions high on the agenda at the G7 meeting. The wars in Ukraine and Gaza led to calls for countries to increase defence spending. And Bloomberg Economics recently estimated that an increase to 4% of GDP, sought by some, would cost governments of G7 countries more than $10 million per year over the next decade. Global economist Bhargavi Shuktewel joined us on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe to discuss their forecasts.
We looked at two specific scenarios for defense spending, one in which US and its partners spend at least 2% of their debt, of their GDP on defense. And then we looked at a more extreme scenario, which emulates the Cold War levels. So if they raise defense spending to 4%. For countries like Germany and Canada, with relatively low levels of forecasted debt and fiscal headroom, this higher spending may be painful, but it's actually feasible. But for a lot of governments, especially Japan, Italy, and maybe even France, they're going to struggle a lot to increase defense spending substantially without there being additional spending cuts somewhere, higher taxes, additional debt, or some combination of the lot. France, Italy, and Spain would be particularly exposed if the extra funding spending is funded by borrowing, with Italy's public debt jumping to 179% of output by 2034 from 144% this year. For the U.S., which is already spending 3.3% on defense, debt could still increase to 131% from 99% this year over the next decade if we pushed up military spending to 4%. That's where we get the $10 trillion number from. The U.S. and major allies together, if they were to reach such levels, that's going to be a large number.
Is an increase of defense spending to 2%, which is the sort of NATO goal, would that be enough to meet the challenges? What's the sort of thinking behind that?
In Europe, there's this need to catch up because its industry has been shrinking after years of low spending on defense. Particularly, like we've been seeing these new style of wars in Ukraine with a lot more focus on air defense. And allies will need to invest in more on that, in air defense and ammunition. And there's also these plans for NATO to put as many as 300,000 troops on higher readiness. And all of that is going to cost a lot of money. And there's also promise of aid to Kyiv, which needs to happen. And some officials are pointing to Cold War levels, where NATO allies spend about 3-4% on defense as what may be needed to deal with these threats.
That was global economist at Bloomberg Economics, Bhargavi Shuktewel, speaking to myself and Caroline Hepker. I'm Stephen Carroll in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Tom?
Thank you, Stephen. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a look ahead at some key economic data in China. Could there be signs of recovery for the slumping Chinese economy? I'm Tom Busby, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Tom Busby in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. We'll be getting a slew of economic data out of China this week, including GDP, industrial production, and retail sales data. Let's get to Bloomberg Daybreak Asia hosts Brian Curtis and Doug Krisner as we look for signs of recovery in the Chinese economy.
Tom, China may be close to turning the corner on its economic recovery, but the jury is still out. Manufacturing picked up in March, and risk assets have seen a bounce of late, but consumer activity has lagged.
And in the coming week, we'll get retail sales numbers along with data on home prices that would be both new and used. These data could give us some insight into the health of the Chinese consumer.
Can consumers emerge from the doldrums and get the economy going again? We put that question to Mark Conan at AIA.
Coming out of the pandemic and then uncertainty around policy, the confusion around geopolitics, the weakness on the currency, the deflation, the cutting rates, all of these have compounded upon sentiment. And I think it's going to take a little bit longer for people to recover from that and for us to see a significant improvement within consumption. That's at an aggregate level. But of course, within that picture, there are those that are prospering, that are able to offer a relative advantage and are continuing to make progress.
Well, joining us now to discuss the plight of the Chinese consumer is Eric Ju, Bloomberg economist covering China and Hong Kong, and Jenny Marsh, team leader for Greater China EcoGov.
Welcome to you both. We're glad you can help us take a look at what's happening with the Chinese domestic economy. A moment ago, Mark Conan mentioned that there have been some winners of late. Two areas of the economy seeing a pickup are manufacturing and exports.
Exports so far this year have surprised on the upside for China, as we've seen. You know, the rest of the world has perhaps continued to grow more vigorously than was expected. China has benefited from that. But that transition towards more of a domestic focus for the economy is certainly a long-term policy aim.
That's Mark Conan at AIA talking about both internal and external inputs into Chinese growth. We thought for the discussion today that we would focus a little bit more on domestic consumption and what it takes to get consumers going again. Jenny, how important is it for the Chinese economy to see some sort of turn up in consumption, and is it coming?
It's absolutely crucial that they see a turn up and upswing in consumption. Because they cannot rely on the factory floor alone to sort of turn the economy around this year. There have been some green shoots, you know, over the recent Qingming holiday. Tourists spent more per trip than any time since 2019. So, you know, that was encouraging. But, you know, outside these sort of big holiday events where pent-up demand is being released, there's still a lot of pressures on people and the sort of the general household. You know, the property crisis is still weighing on confidence. You know, and you can see that the CPI is sort of a reflection of that weak demand. You know, the people are not buying enough, and therefore prices are continuing to sort of feel these deflationary pressures at the moment.
Eric, the services economy is a very broad category. We know that. But when you look at the sentiment vis-a-vis the official PMI data, what do we know about business sentiment in the services industries?
I think if you look at the PMI, you know, services in early this year, I think it's generally show that they're doing well during the holiday, but if you look at periods outside of a holiday, you know, those consumption, those high-frequency data actually show that people are not really spending much except for the holiday. And even if you look at holiday data, we just got the early April holiday, and the per day, you know, the per capita spending was still not as strong as before, right? So you see, yeah, lots of people are traveling, but they're not really spending as much. So some part of it can be, you know, some cultural shift, right? Young people, they no longer spend lots of money on shopping around. They more value experience, you know, in the travels. And we also see similar pattern even in overseas tourism. If we look at data from visitor from China in Hong Kong, in Japan, we did some analysis and see it's a very similar story. People coming back to those tourist visits, but they're not really spending as much as before.
It seems like housing is at the root of a lot of the spending issues, that people just don't feel so confident with their overall wealth and about their security economically going forward. And so we need to see some improvement there. And Eric, let me put a question to you that's tied to policy making. We did see a few newspapers talking about this just in the past couple of days, about cities removing some of the lower limits for mortgage rates on first-time home buying, and generally just loosening the strings a little bit on housing policies. Is that going to work?
I have to say those incremental, those small steps, it has proved that it's not working very well so far. Mm-hmm. I think since the second half of last year, we have seen lots of, you know, easing steps from local governments on loosening mortgage rates and, you know, relaxing some home purchase rules. But it's all step by step, small loosening, and we haven't seen any, you know, big impact from those policies. So that suggests, you know, you probably need more aggressive, you know, more proactive easing steps. Someone would suggest that you should relax remove, just like Hong Kong, remove all the home purchasing, you know, relax the restrictions, especially in the tier one cities in China.
Jenny, last year, I think the government unveiled a plan to boost household spending on everything from electric appliances to furniture, things like that. How is that working? Is it been an effective prescription to try to revitalize a bit of spending?
Not so far. So this is the sort of cash for clunkers program they rolled out. And it's really the government's sort of big swing at trying to boost consumer spending, essentially raising the standards for electronics across a broad range of sectors, forcing people to sort of hand in their old goods and buy new ones. I think that it's going to be rolled out sort of in a piecemeal way, province by province. And we've been monitoring closely to sort of watch for the beginning of this program. And we haven't yet seen signs that it has sort of been put into effect. But, you know, the rollout has been quite slow so far, so we're not going to see the effects from it yet. There was a note this week saying it could raise GDP by 0.9% when you look at the industrial impact of everything that would need to be manufactured for the program. So it could be significant, but it's going to be rolled out over a series of years, and it hasn't yet come into effect.
Recently, in a discussion about the latest CPI and PPI data, we caught up with Wei Yao, chief economist for the Asia-Pacific at SocGen. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, it was a mixed bag. You had very negative PPI, but everybody expected that, and it was in line. Consumer prices, as you mentioned earlier, Jenny, they did advance, but only just 0.1%. So what was interesting was I mentioned to Wei Yao, well, at least that's a little bit of positive news, and we can listen to her answer here. She also started to bring in policy in China.
Maybe it's just a wee bit of good news, but I think structurally things haven't really changed much. If you look at the economic situation in China, it continued to be a challenge of not enough domestic demand and a lot of supply. So this and the policy on the policy front, there is not much significant to address this issue.
So Jenny, if we were looking at policy, if we had, you know, a wish list of things that we thought would be necessary to be done by the policymakers to get consumers moving, what would be high on your list?
I think there are no quick fixes. I mean, they could offer consumers sort of direct stimulus, i.e. sort of giving them cash handouts to boost spending. But, you know, if you do that, the underlying structural problems still remain, right? So you'll still have the property crisis there, which is really underpinning household wealth and sort of the root of a lot of the problems. You know, when Janet Yellen came to Beijing last week, she basically advocated for sort of a rethink of the Chinese economic policy in order to boost consumption, rebalance the economy. And the things that she was proposing were not short-term suggestions. You know, she was saying improve pension security, make education more affordable, you know, things that make people feel like they don't need to keep saving because of this high household saving rate in China. People, the social security net isn't there. If something happens and you fall very ill, you know, you're going to have to pay for your medical care. You know, you need to save for your retirement because there isn't a good state-funded pension program. So this is all part of the broader framework, and there's no easy fix, in my opinion, for getting people spending again. Obviously, if things improve and the economy looks better, people will feel more buoyed. But, you know, there's some big problems there, and these are sort of deep-seated spending habits.
So playing off that, Eric, I'm wondering if you're a policymaker, would you necessarily push banks into reducing deposit rates as a way of discouraging savings and maybe forcing some more money, more liquidity into the economy?
That could be help, but I think the fundamental problem the policymaker needs to address is the expectation of the household and the business, right? So in the past, everybody is expecting that economy is booming, right? The property market is booming, so I'm going to, you know, make more money, and my property is going to worth more in the future. So it's okay for me to, you know, spend more now. But I think now the expectation kind of, you know, reverse, right? So everybody was expecting they're having probably harder time looking forward, especially, you know, giving, you see lots of news about, you know, so some financial sector, they're cutting salaries, right? They're cutting, you know, payments. So I think the people's expectation is not very high at this moment, with the economy slowing, with lots of restrictive kind of regulation trying to, you know, contain the income growth, and that's put more pressure and, you know, people feeling if really my life is going to get better, you know, looking forward. So I would probably, you know, save more and now, you know, just to prepare for worse days.
There are some technical reasons, too, sometimes where people don't spend. For instance, the government just asked hotels to accept foreign credit cards for people traveling. Could the Chinese authorities do more to try to really stimulate domestic tourism, light a fire there, and even encourage people to go to Macau?
I think people are really going there, right? But I'm not sure if they're really spending go to the those casinos because they're not as, you know, as willing to spend as before. So it's not really only on spending money on purchasing goods. It also applied to, you know, spending money on gambling.
Jenny, I'm curious about the degree to which the story on weak domestic demand is tied to a labor market that may be struggling, particularly where young people are concerned. Is that a part of the narrative here?
Yeah. You know, you've got very strong youth unemployment, and even the overall employment rate last month erased all the gains it had made since the previous 6 months. So you're seeing a decline in employment rates overall. So you have this weak labor market. So the overall landscape for the Chinese consumer is pretty poor. I do think on the sort of the sentiment side, the flip of it is after 3 years of COVID, there is pent up demand for experiences. People are sort of excited about traveling. We're seeing that in the numbers, but they're changing how they're spending. So they're preferring to go to third and fourth tier cities. It's not as high value spending as before.
We'll have to leave it there. Jenny, thanks so much for joining us. Jenny Marsh, team leader for Greater China EcoGov at Bloomberg, and Eric Ju, Bloomberg economist covering China and Hong Kong. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner. You can catch us every weekday for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 8 a.m. in Hong Kong and 8 p.m. on Wall Street. Tom?
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Doug. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on the markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Tom Busby. Stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.